I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Two new reports are out from CEOs for Cities, and their authors are with us today to discuss their findings. Charles Leadbeater, who consults worldwide on innovation strategy, suggests that cities now face problems more like clouds than clocks that cannot be solved with traditional top-down approaches. Joe Courtwright claims cities have advantages that are going unrecognized. They offer more variety, convenience, discovery, and opportunity, and these advantages are the source of economic strength. We'll talk with Charlie Leadbeater and Joe Courtwright about their new reports right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Charles Leadbeater has advised companies, cities, and governments around the world on innovation strategy and drawn on that experience in writing his forthcoming book, We Think, The Power of Mass Creativity, which charts the rise of mass participative approaches to innovation from science and open source software to computer games and political campaigning. A visiting senior fellow at the British National Endowment for Science, Technology, and the Arts, he is also a longstanding senior research associate with the influential London think tank Demos. His report for CEOs for Cities is titled Remixing Cities Strategy 2.0. So, Charlie, back in May, we toured four U.S. cities talking to mayors, meeting with urban leaders, looking for examples of platforms that enable citizens to contribute their talent to improving cities. What did you see on that trip that influenced your thinking?
Well, I saw, I suppose, three kinds of different things. The first is I was very struck by Mayor Coleman in Columbus, who said very clearly, mayors are there to deliver, city leaders need to deliver. And so you get that very strong sense of the pressure that city leaders are under to deliver better education, better health, better environment, so on and so forth. The second thing, I think, is that all cities are grappling with problems which they realize are beyond simple solutions often. They might have bits of them that have clear solutions, but actually the whole picture is quite complicated. And so if you want better education, you need to think about family policies as well as schools. If you want better environment, you need to think about transport and energy as well as the kind of obvious things about waste. So these problems need mobilizing a lot of people. And then the third thing is that you see more cities attempting to start to try and do those things. And so whether it's Chicago's Full Circle initiative to give people more information so they can organize in their own neighborhoods, or Portland's approach to recycling, you see this recognition that city needs to create this kind of like a civic multiplier, where what the city leadership does or the city council does has this multiplier effect by getting more people involved.
Where are the models for a civic multiplier?
Well, I think we can look to some cities around the world which understand this and do it either because they have to out of necessity because they've got no resources. So in poorer parts of the world, in Brazil, in India, you see some examples of this. I think there are really good examples like Portland in the United States and others where this has been done. I think actually in a funny kind of way, you can look back to see some of it. Actually, some of the older models of British cities where city leaders did this. But I also think that you can start looking to these new business models emerging around Web 2.0 and others, which are very strong on community. They're very bottom heavy. They engage people as participants. They do quite a lot of the work themselves. And they really, these models work by bringing people together to exchange and to share and to generate stuff with one another, not just to have stuff delivered to them. And this is a really important change.
Based on your visits, you've written a new report just published by CEOs for Cities called Remixing Cities Strategy 2.0. Summarize the report's main themes for me.
Well, I guess the starting point is this idea that cities face these different kinds of problems, that we distinguish between problems that are like clouds and problems that are like clocks. And clock problems are complicated, but they have a solution. Cloud problems is like dealing with this thing that's amorphous and diffuse and difficult. And more of the problems that cities dealing with feel like clouds. They're difficult to get hold of. You can't cut through them. You can't put a box around them. And so what we're trying to do in the report, I think, is argue for how you get at some of those problems, how you'd encourage a culture of learning in a city, not just better schools, how you'd encourage the population to be healthier, not just a good hospital service, how you'd make the city safer, not just have a good police service. And so to get at those kinds of solutions, we're arguing we could borrow some of these models from Web 2.0 as ways of thinking about how you get people engaged in participating in creating solutions for themselves. That's not a recipe for more consultation or more committees or more public engagement necessarily of a traditional kind. It's how can you do really practical things that can really make a difference to people's experience of their lives.
I'm wondering how you get that conversation started, because today all the money is tied up in schools, not in education or not in learning beyond schools. There's no department of learning. There's a department of education. There's no department of safety. There's a department. There's the police department or the fire department. So everything is very parceled out today. How do you begin to change that thinking? Where's the entry point?
Well, it's really, really difficult. And that journey from, realizing, I mean, this was one of the things that we found on our trip, I think, is that everywhere we went, we found public officials who'd say, yeah, I recognize that problem that, we've got this limited budget and we work in these institutions, but actually the problems are much bigger and they're out there in the community and we're here in our institutions. And so a great recognition of the problem, but how do you get from A to B? How do you shift? Well, I think there are probably two or three things that help that shift. Firstly, I think there is a growing body of people within these systems who recognize now their limitations and they want to adjust and change them. Police officers recognize that actually their jobs get made easier if estates are safer and they can police themselves. Teachers recognize their jobs are easier if children are well fed and they're learning at home and there is support outside. So I think there's a growing recognition that the productivity of these institutions goes up if they're in this kind of context. The second is that I think there are some initiatives coming from outside the system, and I think it's very important to enable people with new ideas who are coming from the outside to shake things up, because that's where new thinking will come from. So I think you find in Chicago there's this company Experientia who've got this different approach to educational experience, not school-based. At the moment, it's a kind of thing on the side of the school system, but actually it could be much, much more central. And then I think you have to empower consumers. You have to empower people, possibly with money, with budgets, support, to start doing things themselves, to design things themselves. And so I'm a great believer that if you put power and money and advice and support around the people rather than the institutions, then they can start devising solutions. Too much of the time in the public sector, we squeeze people into the institutions that we've already got rather than creating solutions around people and their needs. And that's what we can do. And I've seen examples in the UK where that's happened, say with people with disabilities who've been freed up and given budgets and much more support. And it unlocks a tidal wave of civic innovation from these people, that they become engaged in finding new solutions in a way that before they were just trapped.
When you talk about these ideas, I the image I get in my head is eBay. eBay as a platform that allows people to do things, buy and sell merchandise. And without the buyers and sellers, eBay's not terribly valuable. I mean, nothing's happening. But eBay enables people to buy and sell, to do things that, in effect, add value. As you think about trying to make your ideas come alive in cities, what's the image you have? I mean, you talked about clocks and clouds. That makes sense to me, and the cloud problems. But that you're describing the problem, as you think about it, do you have a metaphor for the solution? What inspires you when you think about solutions here?
Well, I think that if you draw those morals and lessons from Web 2.0, then you say, well, what would those kinds of solutions mean to education and learning? Well, you'd have a kind of eBay for learning, for instance, where people could say, I want to learn how to program a computer with this particular music software and find someone who could teach them. There are all sorts of skills and knowledge in the community that people could get access to, which go way beyond what's available in the school system. Or there could be social networks for learning, which mums could help one another to with reading and literacy and so on and so forth. There might be different kind of Wikipedias for helping kids learn particular kinds of curriculum, social networking, YouTube. I mean, we've seen kids doing stuff on YouTube, presenting themselves, presenting ideas, and yet still, by and large, certainly in our education system in the UK, it's about textbooks, writing, sitting, listening. It's not about making videos. So, you know, I think there's just a huge potential for taking all of that stuff and saying, well, if we applied this to creating, you know, more creative education, more engaged citizens, a better healthcare system, what could we really do with it? I think there's huge potential in it.
What is the new insight? If you had to sort of boil it down and say, what's the new insight in this report, what would it be?
Well, I think the new insight in all of this stuff is see people as participants and contributors. Don't see them as consumers and as needy. See them as potential people who can help provide some of the solution rather than just people who need to be served or controlled or managed or what have you. And if you try and do that and then you flip the system on its head and then you see, well, maybe, you know, if you could get 5% of the older kids in Chicago schools to become lead learners and to help other kids and be peer mentors and providing kids with all kinds of recognition for what they're doing, could we do that? What would that do to the system? What would it do to discipline, to engagement, to achievement, so on and so forth? If you could just get a portion of the mothers in Chicago to become engaged in that kind of way, what would it do? So too much of the time, I think we're still trapped in this notion that we're delivering things to people who need stuff. And as it gets more expensive and more difficult to deliver stuff, we control who gets it and tighten up the requirements. And what we've got to get towards is thinking, well, how can we turn people into participants in providing solutions to problems they have in their lives? And that has a longer-term benefit.
I think it's interesting that you point out if we could get 5%, if we could get 10%. So, which to me is encouraging because it lays out the notion that you don't have to make everyone a participant. You need to give them the opportunity to participate. But a big difference could be made if you could get really only a small percentage. And I know you've used the example of video games in that way as an example of what we could look to in the social service or human service realm. Talk about that a minute.
Well, all these models on the web and these communities, Wikipedia, World of Warcraft, which is a big mass online game and what have you, they all engage a mass of people, but they have a core usually, which is relatively small. So, you know, about 8,000 people do the lion's share of work on Wikipedia. 6 million articles, 7% of internet traffic. It's really 8,000 people who are doing the core of the work. So it's not a question of getting everyone to be participants initially anyway. It's finding just the right core of a community that could get something going. And then out of that, something could grow. And if you can find that, and you know, any ward politician knows that actually if you find the right, you know, 10 people who can network together, and then they might get 50 people who might then get 200 people. It's that kind of thing. So it's not about just let 1,000 flowers bloom. It's find the people who could become the kind of core to these new ways of working, and then build out from them.
What's the biggest obstacle to making this happen? Where will the resistance come from?
Well, the biggest obstacle to making any of this happen is that resources are tied up in existing institutions with existing professional codes, with existing metrics, and so on and so forth. And that is where we look to solutions for these problems often as citizens and consumers. And the biggest problem is, how do you shift them out of that mindset into something different? So in the UK, as in the States, one of the biggest challenges in health is the growth of obesity, linked to that diabetes and other kind of diseases. Well, by the time a diabetic gets to the hospital, it's too late, really. You've got to try and get earlier than that. And even if someone does become diabetic, you know, the issue is then how do you manage that condition really effectively? So we've got to think more about the problems are out there and the solutions have to be in there rather than being inside our institutions.
If a city were to embrace the ideas that you've put forward in REMIX, what would you expect as a change that would result from that? I mean, how do you imagine a city being different?
Well, I think, how would you imagine a city being different? I think that you would, I would hope that you would see that around any kind of core activity that was put in place by the city council or leadership or government, that actually it would generate a whole mass of other stuff, and that it would be this sort of generation of all this multiplier of other stuff going on that would really make the difference. And so, you know, for every pound you put into a school, you might get, you know, another, you know, every dollar you put into a school, you might get another $2 of individual effort and voluntary effort out of it. And so you would, I think, expect, say in sustainability, you'd expect, I think, you know, city government to take some really important initiatives and maybe some important stuff about recycling, about transport, maybe even congestion charging and things like that. But you'd see a mass of other initiatives, local initiatives, going on as well, and social enterprises emerging to take them. And so I think in successful cities like this, you see what we call in the report this kind of washing machine of kind of city government leading to then private entrepreneurs coming in with services or civic entrepreneurs coming in with other activities. And they're kind of building on one another.
Can you describe, in summary, the philosophy that exists today around talent and what you imagine to be a better way?
Well, I think at the moment, I think the kind of traditional, by which I mean over the last, you know, 10 years, heavily influenced probably by Richard Florida's work, The implication is if you can attract kind of cultural and creative talent, that can sometimes then create the environment in which other knowledge workers in services, business services and others like to congregate, and then you've got the core of a kind of knowledge economy in a city, and that then creates jobs in personal services and so on and so forth. And the truth is that for me, I think, is too narrow and can be too elitist a view of what generates a really successful city. And I think the really successful cities are marked by the way that they engage everyone, and that their sense of talent is a talent for doing things that are local or doing things with kids or, you know, a talent in care services. Or, you know, you could imagine talent being a much more broadly spread kind of capacity. And rather than looking for a kind of savior class to come along and save the city, actually the most successful cities, I think Portland is a really good example in the United States. Curitiba in Brazil is another very good example, where you get this kind of mass welling up of creativity from all sorts of sources, not just from a single source. And so as a result, these cities are more adaptive, they're stronger, and they've got a sort of broadly spread kind of engagement that's constantly stimulating them.
You are just finishing up a new book, we think. The first draft, or a number of chapters from the first draft, were on the web for some long period of time, and you invited readers to comment on those chapters. I'm curious what you learned from that process and what you were able to incorporate from readers' comments.
Well, the first thing is people like it. They like the fact that you've been that open. masses of downloads of it. The second is you then get, I got all sorts of comments from people, virtually all of them useful, some in very small ways. I think I calculated I got about 270 comments, and probably about 10% of them were substantial. So there were probably about 25 to 30. And there were people who devoted quite a lot of time to reading it and thinking about it and sending me ideas. And so out of that, I got one or two things which really changed how I wrote the book, and people pointed out other books for me to read. So as a way of approaching these things, I think it definitely works, and I think it has a huge potential. But then you also learn that people want to contribute in the way that they want to contribute. The conversation doesn't take place where you necessarily want it to take place, that actually it's taking place on their websites or in their blogs or so on and so forth. And that it has a life of its own if it kind of, you know, takes off. But it's definitely I think that communities get going when people sort of make gifts, really, and that communities of creativity get going when often people make a sort of gift and then a community forms around them. And that certainly happened with scientific communities. That's the history of science. Is it? Basically, Newton wrote to the Royal Society in 1672, and they published his theory of light and colour, and out of that came the really first big scientific community. So I think that's the story of cities as well, is that cities kind of create public spaces and these kind of almost like gifts around which communities then can grow.
Do you think there are things that urban leaders can do to encourage those gifts?
Yeah, I think that they can. I think this city that we're in today, Chicago, I think Millennium Park and that kind of stuff down there is a fantastic example of creating a space where the city can kind of breathe and come alive and see itself and be in conversation with itself and feel good about itself, and you feel the city coming together in those places. And so I think you can do that in those ways, but I think, you know, through education systems, transport systems, there's a huge need for creative public infrastructures in cities. And so that's the continuing story. But always, how does something public then join with something social and something private to generate more value? That's the question. Because the public or the city or the government on its own isn't going to create really lasting solutions. It's when it joins with these other things that really creates dynamism.
Where do you see the best examples of those, of that creative infrastructure in place?
Well, I think you see it in different cities, in different places. I mean, and you see small examples. Some cities do it all well. Curitiba in Brazil, I think, does a lot of it really, really well. But its transport system is its kind of signature. Paris has just created this system of bicycles in the city. Cheap, really easy to use, and the city's just gone wild about it. And it's that kind of sense of creating something that's public, but, you know, you have to pay for it, but everyone can use it and they share it. And, you know, everywhere people are using these bikes. And there's just a sense of kind of civicness about it, which kind of has brought the city to life and added a crucial dimension to it. So I think there are lots and lots of examples of that kind, where you can do creative things which really then allows people to be creative in their own lives. You know, like a city map is like that. A good, you know, good city map is public, it's shared, but it's used by individuals to do all sorts of different things. And that's what makes cities tick, I think.
Remixing Cities Strategy 2.0 is available from ceosforcities.org. When will We Think be on the bookshelves?
We Think will be on the bookshelves in the UK in March, and in the United States shortly after.
Charles Leadbeater is author of the new report from CEOs for Cities, Remixing Cities, Strategy 2.0. After a short break, we'll find out about another new report released this week by CEOs for Cities from Joe Courtwright on the City Advantage. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
These days, more and more people are starting to get concerned about the environment. With all the threats of global warming, one of the most commonly mentioned methods for reducing the human contribution is to improve fuel efficiency in cars. Though this would bring down the amount of greenhouse gas emissions each car coughs out into the atmosphere, a new book from the Urban Land Institute argues that any positive effect seen by improved efficiency will be offset by the increasing auto reliance created by the pattern of sprawl development. The book says that a projected 59% increase in the amount of miles people drive in the next two decades will more than overwhelm any gains made in fuel efficiency, even in the best-case scenario. The authors say both auto efficiency and compact design must be encouraged in unison for any true progress to be made. Meanwhile, these same improvements in fuel efficiency are threatening the taxes that support the nation's transportation system, and some university researchers are looking for ways to counteract the drain on funding. USA Today reports that drivers in six states will soon begin testing out a new system for determining how people pay for roads and transit. For 2 years, 2,700 volunteer drivers will have computers installed in their cars that monitor their driving and charge them taxes based on how many miles they drive, as opposed to the current taxation method of charging by the gallon. This is part of a University of Iowa experiment to weigh the feasibility of altering the major funding mechanism for the country's highways, streets, and transit systems. The federal government and 15 states are funding this effort. And some transportation analysts say that with this type of support, the system could be implemented nationwide within 20 years. And in New York, transportation officials have announced plans to create the city's first physically separated bike lane. According to Streets Blog, the proposed bike lane will run directly next to the sidewalk, but be shielded from street traffic by car parking and a planted buffer zone, creating what officials are calling the city's first ever completely separate bike path. The new lane is expected to run for about 7 blocks in Manhattan. Many bike advocates had wished for more, but planners have cited the difficulties of adding dedicated lanes to streets with many intersections. But in order to prevent or reduce the amount of car-bike accidents caused by turning vehicles, the city plans to equip all intersections with left-turn signals for cars, and traffic signals for the bicyclists as well. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Joe Courtwright has been our guest many times on Smart City. He is an economist and principal with Impresa Consulting based in Portland, Oregon, specializing in regional economic analysis, innovation, and industry clusters. Joe is also the chief economic analyst for the Oregon Business Plan, a multi-year private sector-led effort to develop the state economy, and for CEOs for Cities. Joe has written extensively on the migration of talented young workers among metropolitan areas in a series of studies entitled The Young and Restless for Cities Around the Nation. His latest report for CEOs for Cities is titled City Advantage. Joe, what is the City Advantage?
Well, historically, we've thought about cities and city economies being driven by the advantages that cities bring to producers and that exist for making things where there are dense concentrations of people and skills. And what City Advantage argues is that cities also have a really important and probably increasingly important set of advantages in helping people find things and consume things.
That sounds politically...
Well, we use the term in the way economists use the term, consumption, meaning all the stuff that we take in, all the stuff that we use, It's not just the physical goods and services we buy in the marketplace. It's our interactions with other people. It's the social environment. It's the civic environment and so on. So when I say consumption, I mean it in the broadest possible sense. And I think, you know, bearing in mind sort of our puritanical roots and our current environmental concerns, we have to recognize there are no production economies unless there's somebody to consume what gets produced. And so we want to be efficient in both production and consumption. Well, being efficient in consumption means getting the stuff that we need that not only meets our basic needs but makes us happy, that contributes to our well-being. And you know, one of the characteristics of economic change over the last several decades has been we've moved away from dealing with basic human necessities, you know, sort of food, clothing, and shelter just purely for survival. And now we're in a world where we're trying to find the stuff that helps us as individuals find what it is we really want. And as our society becomes increasingly diverse, different people want different things. And one of the arguments behind City Advantage is that cities are great places for diverse groups of people with different interests to all find what it is that they need.
You say there are four city advantages. Tell me more about each one. Let's start with variety. What do you mean by variety, and how does it become a city advantage?
Well, by variety, we mean that there are lots of different kinds of choices that are open to people. Choices of not only goods to purchase, but services, and services play an important role in our economy, and also opportunities for personal and social and cultural interaction. And what cities do and what their key advantage is they provide consumers, and again in a very broad sense, all the things that they want close at hand. So it's a much more diverse menu of choices that are available in cities. And that sheer variety makes cities a better place to live than places that have fewer choices.
Is variety a function of size?
Well, size certainly enables you to provide more varieties. Some things require a certain number of people in order to support them. It's hard to have a town with 1,000 people and support a Major League Baseball team. So only very large places can offer some things. But in many cases, there are places that offer richer variety with the same number of people or the same size as other cities. So size helps you get more variety, but it isn't the only factor that influences it.
So why is it that some cities of the same size can offer a richer variety?
Well, that's something that we haven't explored, but we have a pretty good idea of what some of the things might be. You might have more cultural diversity. You might have a bigger immigrant population. You might have a community that's gone through several waves of development, attracting different people or developing at different times. You might also have more economic diversity within a community. And all of those things would tend to produce greater variety. And then also the openness to new ideas and to innovation, something that we've explored in other studies, is some places are just more embracing of and open to differences and to change. The sort of sentiment that's captured in the sort of keep Austin weird sentiment that people often talk about.
Convenience is the second city advantage. How do you define convenience?
Well, convenience starts with the recognition that when we're consuming things, when we're consuming goods and services, it takes us time and effort to find what it is that we want and then to get it. And the key advantage of cities, or one of the key advantages of cities, is more things are closer to where you are. So you don't have to search as far and you don't have to travel as far to get any particular item that you're likely to need, averaged over all of the things that you might want to get. So cities enable consumers to economize both on time and then also on what economists call search costs, the cost of looking for things. And that's a big advantage, particularly to people who are stressed for time, for dual income households, for higher income people. They will put a premium on the ability to save time. And that's one of the real attractions of cities, is for time pressured people, more of the things that they want are close at hand.
Let me ask you about cost of living studies. You've challenged this notion of measuring cost of living in the way it is currently measured and looking at cost of living as an advantage. Tell me what you've found.
Yeah, those cost of living studies often or almost always look at a very narrow list of commodities. And by design, they choose things that are almost universally available, the sort of things that you can find no matter where you go. And the big difference in the cost of living between places is not the tiny variations in the cost of sort of ubiquitous things, things like ketchup, which are essentially really the same price everywhere. It's the very large, in fact, infinite range of prices of things that you can't get in some places. So if you're in a small town in Wyoming, the price of sushi is effectively infinite because there simply isn't any. And the trouble with a lot of these cost of living indices is they simply ignore a lot of the things, a lot of the choices, a lot of the products that people would otherwise buy if they were available. And so essentially they're biased against cities because cities don't offer so much the cheapest price, but they do offer the widest variety. And that means there are a lot of things that are available at some price in a city that are just simply unavailable at any price in a lot of other places.
Do you see the advantages of variety and convenience becoming magnified as our tastes become more sophisticated and our time becomes more valuable?
The story of economic change in the United States in the last particularly 40 or 50 years has not been that we're so much consuming more, you know, washing machines. It's that we're consuming a much, much greater variety of things. The average supermarket in the United States has three times as many different kinds of commodities in it, products in it, than it did 15 or 20 years ago. We can now get the goods and services that most closely match our tastes and interests, as opposed to having to settle for something that was okay, but was not what we really wanted. And one of the real offshoots of digital technology and of the greater efficiency in manufacturing has been the ability to produce a wider and wider variety of things. And what cities do is cities are especially good in the production of services. Most services have the element that you have to be present in order to consume them. You have to be present for a medical exam. You have to be present for hairstyling. You have to be present for a lot of live entertainment. You have to be present for a good restaurant meal. So those services are the things where cities provide the greatest variety of choices to consumers.
So that's the answer to those who say that internet shopping will offset any physical or locational advantages.
Yeah, and that's true. There, for goods, you can kind of make the argument that it doesn't matter, although there's some good evidence that people who live in places where there are lots of bookstores consume more books per capita than people who live further away. So it's the presence of choices again. And you know, if you think about interaction and exploration, which is the next point really in our discussion, cities provide opportunities for people to really take advantage of that wide array of choices.
You're talking about discovery as the third city advantage. I relate to that because I have a Borders bookstore across the street from my office, and I frequently will pop in there once or twice a week and unfortunately discover things I wasn't looking for and take them to the checkout. So again, I feel like I'm living discovery as a city advantage.
Yeah, one of the assumptions that traditional economic analysis brings to an analysis of efficiency is an assumption essentially that people already know exactly what it is that they want, and that the role of the market is really just simply to help people get the things or choose among the things that they already are fully aware of. Well, we know from our personal experience, from the evolution of our own tastes, that we don't always know what we want. We don't even know what's out there, and we don't know what we like. And if you think about your own childhood, you know, that was a large experience typified, for example, by your parents telling you to eat your peas, of exposing you to things that you hadn't had any prior experience with and deciding which things you liked and which things you didn't like. And what cities are, really, is places where people can discover things that they didn't know existed and decide whether they like them or not. In the words of Donald Rumsfeld, there are unknown unknowns out there, things that we didn't even know existed. And cities are places where we get exposed to them, where one young man told us in the city he lived in that it was easy to stumble on the fun, which he meant was finding out about events, about activities, about people, and about things that he simply didn't know existed.
Finally, you say cities offer opportunity. How do cities offer superior opportunity?
Well, if you look at cities, cities have a huge amount of density of jobs. There are lots of jobs in a small place. And particularly for people who are developing their careers, who are likely to change jobs from time to time, the fact that there's a dense job market in cities makes it easy to find your way through the job market, to get your skills recognized, to develop your skills, and become more valuable. And there's some really good economic work that's been done that's quantified how much of an advantage, how much of a boost to skills workers get from being in cities, because they can find their way to jobs, and the jobs themselves are ones that develop their skills. And cities provide some other things, too. They help us develop what is called Know Who. It's our web of personal connections. And cities, because you are building networks with other people in similar careers, you're building social networks and so on, those kinds of networks, which are very important to finding jobs, are richer in cities than they are in other places. Particularly for young workers, for people who are developing the informal networks and the sets of skills that they need to have to be successful in their careers, cities are very, very good places to pursue opportunity. They're also a great place to start businesses because, again, as we mentioned before, they've got a diverse range of consumers. It's more likely that you'll find the set of people who like your particular niche product in a city than it is in a less dense, less diverse place. So cities, by virtue of being places where people are open to exploration and confronting new alternatives, are places that are great places to start businesses. And then finally, cities provide opportunity for a problem or for a challenge that's really emerged in the last few decades, which is typically when we're talking about workers looking to develop their careers, we're no longer talking about just one worker, we're talking about two workers. Because young women today are just as likely, in fact, somewhat more likely to be college educated than their male counterparts among young adults. That means that those young couples are looking to pursue not just one career, but two careers. And cities, because, again, of their greater diversity and size, are more likely to have the set of career ladders open for two different careers than are much smaller places.
As you talk about these city advantages, Joe, it occurs to me that people living in suburbs close to cities also enjoy these city advantages. True?
Yeah, the city advantages are sort of, you can think of being as sort of nested. The greatest advantage probably occurs to people who live in large cities and close in larger cities. But the people who live in other parts of those large cities can take advantage, perhaps to a little bit lesser extent, of some of those city advantages. And smaller cities, again, depending on their diversity and so on, will have some of those advantages. So it's not an absolute thing. It's really more of a continuum that exists across cities and then within cities.
Several years ago, Ed Glaser at Harvard advanced the idea of the consumer city. Is your research a continuation of Glaser's ideas, or how do they differ, if at all?
Well, I think, certainly Ed Glaser deserves a huge amount of credit for triggering interest in this, and we're trying to build on some of the foundation that he's offered. I think we've added a couple of new twists to that in terms of talking about the discovery process, how people figure out what it is that they're interested in, and they give some real practical illustrations in the area of opportunity as well. So I think really we're in the first steps between our work and the work that Ed Glaser's done of getting a lot more concrete, a lot more specific about this aspect of city economies.
Based on your argument, it would seem that mid-sized cities are at a disadvantage to larger cities. True?
Well, judged purely from the standpoint of their ability to offer as many things, they're not going to be as strong. But I think that the way to look at it is that every city offers a different mix of costs and benefits, of choice and affordability. And so mid-sized cities are simply going to be competing in a different way and probably for a different set of people than are the largest cities. So different cities will have different kinds of advantages based on their own distinctiveness.
If I am a leader of a mid-sized city, I don't think I'd be really happy about what I've just heard.
Well, I think one of the things you want to do is look really hard at what it is that your city offers, and recognizing that you have potential advantages in each of these areas, in variety, in convenience, in discovery and opportunity. Can you look at what's going on in your economy to see if you're making the most of those things in your community? And can you do things to stimulate those things? Because you may be worried about the next, larger city up the tier, but you may also be competing against other cities of the same size or smaller size that are less well-positioned to compete against you in terms of what they offer in the way of variety, convenience, opportunity, and discovery. I think cities can do things that either emphasize variety, and you mentioned local distinctiveness. I think when you promote local distinctiveness, that helps. I think you want to avoid thinking of how you position yourself in economic terms in terms of just being cheaper, because that's less important, I think, than indicating what kind of benefits you offer to the people who live in your community in terms of the variety and convenience of experiences. I think cities can do a lot to try and encourage discovery. And that's one of the ways to promote entrepreneurship, because if people are open to new ideas, that creates a market for new jobs, for new goods and services that both benefit local consumers and then provide a platform for growing your economy. So there are a lot of really specific things that cities can do that will tap into what may be latent advantages in even the mid-sized cities.
Joe, is this new work city advantage going to turn the economic development paradigm on its head?
Well, I think we've been in the process of kind of an evolution here in how we think about the economies, the economy. For a long time, we thought about solely about production, about manufacturing firms, and about how cheap it was for them. And in the last few years, people have paid a lot more attention to the creation of ideas and about human capital, the kind of skills that workers have. And once we started paying attention to human capital, we noticed that human beings chose to live in some places and not in others, and that those migration choices that people made influenced how well their productive economies worked. And this is really just the next stage in that evolution to say, what is it about cities and about some cities in particular that attracts those talented people with human capital to come to work and create ideas and help drive businesses? So I view it as more of an evolution than a revolution, but I think it gives us a much richer view of what drives economies and where the levers are for public leaders to try and influence their economic destiny.
Joe Courtwright is author of the new report from CEOs for Cities called City Advantage. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. What does it take in order to call a place home? CityView's commentator Walker Smith asks, what do you value?
When the company he worked for was sold to a competitor, a good friend of mine, Steve, was relocated from his hometown to a big city far away. Steve did okay, but he and his family never felt at home in this new city. They looked forward to the day when they could move back, which happened a few years later. Steve says they hit the road packed to the gills, determined to drive through the night, only to make a U-turn at the interstate. Back at his house, Steve went to the spot in his backyard where a year before he had buried his dog. This dog had been a merry 17-year-old who would skitter into a room, her short legs a blur of energy, half mad with the exhilaration of being in your company. that afternoon before he could leave the city he'd endured to go home to the town he'd missed. He dug up the sealed box of her remains and placed them in the back seat of his car to be reinterred in the old hometown to which he and his family were headed. Steve said to me, only somewhat tongue-in-cheek, "I hated that city so much I couldn't even bear to leave my dead dog in it." We all know this feeling. No matter where we live, there is a place in our hearts that we know as home. Many years ago, I put down stakes too. I decided that it would take more than a new job to get me to move again. When work has required it, I fly back and forth. My weekends, at least, are spent where we've made a home. Even though I still spend a lot of time away, I now have a sense of continuity and connection to a place that I can point to with my wife and say, "This is home for us." I guess this is why my friend's story resonates so strongly with me. The more I hear him deliver that punchline about his dog, the more I've come to realize that my friend's story is as much about what we bring to a place as it is about the place to which we bring ourselves. Home isn't any one place so much as it is where we invest the best part of ourselves. It is where we commit our time and make our attachments. Home is where, like Steve, we bring what we value the most. Beneath all of the tough guy bravado that Steve uses to tell his tale is a story less about a town and more about a dog. Coming home was as much about what he brought back as where he came back to. He just flat out loved that dog too much not to take her back with him, because it could never have felt like home without her there too. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book with Ann Klurman, Generation Ageless, will be in bookstores October 2nd. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.